Hi and welcome to the 17th episode of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. This episode is In Closing. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow, and I blog at splitthemoon.com, and I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Vocal Blog Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Last week, the state rested its case against Adnan, presenting its witnesses and evidence. It took nearly a month to do so. So now comes Tina's turn to lay out her defense of Adnan, to rebut the state's evidence, to present new evidence, and to tell the jury Adnan's side of the story.
Before we get to the witness testimony, there are a few exhibits that Gutierrez tried to get into her case. Some she succeeded on, some she did not. For instance, she tried to introduce the videotape of Jay's initial September 7th plea hearing, but the guilty plea is ultimately excluded for a few reasons, foremost of which is that it wasn't actually a guilty plea. As the court points out, although the state's calling it a guilty plea, it's not actually one. So what's the purpose in introducing it? Because on a real guilty plea, Jay would have given a statement of facts and explained what he was confessing to. That didn't happen here. It's just him saying basically, I will plead guilty at a future date, and nothing more. Gutierrez does try and claim that it's actually impeachment evidence because Jay testified that he was not under oath at the time of this plea litany or this half-fake whatever it was plea litany. But the court, and I think rightly, says no, that's not really impeachment. That's far too collateral. And the tape does not come in.
I'm not going to admit the tape. The tape is going to be excluded. It will not be shown to the jury because I don't find that it's relevant. I think it's a waste of time. It goes off on a tangent of an issue that is not going to have any significant bearing on the facts and circumstances, and it will confuse the jury in that unless you show them the whole tape, and the only thing that the whole tape is going to show is that he did take an oath at one point during something that we can't call a guilty plea because it really wasn't a guilty plea because there were no facts that were given. He doesn't make a statement in any way, and I don't find that it will advance justice.
Which means the state got what it wanted. Because of this weird plea deal it had with Jay, it avoided having that evidence in front of the jury because, again, it really wasn't a plea, despite the fact they were calling it one. Gutierrez does, however, get the tape in of Linkin Park. She has forgotten about her previous motion from the first trial, in which she was going to take the jury to Linkin Park to see it for themselves. But at least they get to see a video from about 8 months later that she took at a visit there with her law clerk and Budemeyer, the state surveyor.
Before we begin talking about the witnesses in the case, one more thing that I want to talk about is something very important, and that's that Adnan does not testify in his defense, and a lot of people have asked about this. He did want to testify. In fact, we all wanted him to testify because as novices, we all expected that anyone who's innocent should take the stand, and that not taking the stand would make you look guilty. So we fully expected that he would testify, and he did too. But Tina, as most criminal defense attorneys will do, advised Adnan completely against it. In hindsight, it probably couldn't have hurt his case, but at the time, Tina thought it could. And I understand that now. Because imagine, if you will, if Adnan was asked by the prosecutor how he felt when Hay broke up with him. If he said he was sad or upset, it makes him look bad. But if he says he was just fine, it still makes him look bad. And it's these kinds of situations that criminal defense attorneys avoid and often don't let their clients take the stand.
You'll obviously get mixed feelings on this from different attorneys, but I agree with the decision not to have Adnan testify. I think the general rule is, at least for me, you do not have the defendant testify unless there's something that they know specifically, something that they can add to the case and no one else can, and you have to have them testify to get it. But if the information you want to add in could come from another witness, I mean, my general inclination in almost every case is going to be to use the other witness, because so much can happen when you put the defendant on the stand. And at that point, it's just as likely they're going to get judged based on their ability to be a good witness as opposed to their actual guilt or innocence.
I mean, one of the circumstances that applies in a lot of cases didn't apply here, which is oftentimes criminal defendants have prior convictions that can be used to impeach them. Obviously not the case with Nan. Sort of a high risk, high reward type situation. My best guess is that Gutierrez saw what happened after the first mistrial where the jurors were leaning toward a not guilty verdict. So she hedged her bets and said, I assume things will go the same at the second trial. Why risk putting him on the stand? It could help the case, but she probably, I imagine, thought she had a good shot of winning and therefore decided against taking that risk. In the end, we heard on Serial, the jurors who were interviewed, they obviously held it very much against Adnan, and that's the risk of not having your client testify. But it's tough in this instance to say that Gutierrez did the right or the wrong thing all these years later.
So now let's get to Christina's witnesses. We're going to start with Drew Davis. And Drew Davis was Christina's own private investigator. He testifies about the $1.71 charge on Hay's credit card at the Crown gas station. Gutierrez tries to use this to show that Hay could have used a credit card after 2:36 p.m. when the state claimed that she had already been killed. Remember, the time on that receipt was on January 13th. But as Susan has discovered, this was a total red herring because the actual charge was from January 11th. It just didn't show up on her credit card bill until a couple of days later. Davis's affidavit was also introduced. And in the affidavit, this is what he said happens when he went to interview Jennifer Pusateri. During this visit, I was greeted by Jennifer's mother and father and was advised by them that they were told by Kathleen Murphy, assistant state's attorney from the state's attorney's office for Baltimore City, that they were not allowed to speak to anyone about this investigation with the exception of Kathleen Murphy and the two lead homicide detectives involved in the investigation. I was further advised by Jennifer Pusateri's mother that she was instructed to phone the state's attorney's office upon my visit to their residence. I went to great lengths to question Ms. Pusateri about the instructions she'd been given, and she advised that she had to follow the orders given to her by the state's attorney's office.
At trial, this didn't get the defense anywhere, but it did lead to an interesting discussion about subpoenas and witnesses and what the defense was doing to prepare for trial. Previously, Urich had told the judge that he'd actually gotten complaints by five prosecution witnesses who were also subpoenaed by the defense. According to Urich, these five witnesses called Gutierrez's office to ask them about their testimony and when they should be there to testify at trial. But the people they talked to at the office wouldn't tell them anything and wouldn't return their calls, and they were left adrift, wondering when they needed to show up, if they'd be in trouble if they weren't there on certain dates. So as a result, on January 18th, Urich wrote the following letter to Judge Hurd. Dear Judge Hurd, most if not all of the persons the state has indicated at one time or another could be possible witnesses have received subpoenas from the defense in the above-captioned case. Some of them have begun to contact me about this matter, for when they try to call the defense attorney, they cannot get any information, whether in fact they will be witnesses or when they might be needed. In the words of one witness, a student who attends college out of state, they acted like they didn't want to talk to me. Should the trial be protracted, many of these persons have potential conflicts. I am enclosing for the court a copy of one such conflict. I will provide additional ones as I become aware of them.
Yeah, so in response to these arguments, Judge Hurd says she doesn't believe the allegation that Gutierrez and her team refused or failed to talk to witnesses that she had subpoenaed, and that she also didn't believe the allegation that Murphy would tell a witness not to talk to anyone for the defense. But I mean, for me at least, this really is a huge question in terms of Gutierrez's trial prep. I don't think that Urich would just completely out of whole cloth make up the allegation about these witnesses being subpoenaed by the defense and then not getting to talk to them. For instance, we have one witness for the prosecution, Hope Schaub. She was the French teacher at Woodlawn. She had been subpoenaed by the defense for both the first and the second trials. And as with other witnesses in the case, we have in the defense files, there was a letter sent by Gutierrez to Hope Schaub saying, once you receive your defense subpoena, can you please call me? Here's my phone number. I want to schedule your appearance. I want to discuss your testimony. And we know that, in fact, Hope Schaub did call Gutierrez because there's a defense memo. And in it, one of Gutierrez's assistants tells Gutierrez that Hope Schaub had called. She wanted to discuss her testimony so she could prepare lesson plans for school and also schedule for a substitute teacher. And there's no record in the defense files of Gutierrez returning that call. And in fact, as Susan was just discussing, when this came up at trial, Gutierrez contends to the court that she never subpoenaed Schaub. But we know she did. We have the records of the subpoena, and it's simply the case of her not returning the call. And we heard there in the letter from Yurik, someone was a college student out of state and was getting the impression the defense didn't want to talk to them. You know, we have maybe five witnesses, maybe more, who Gutierrez and her team, for whatever reason, were pushing off. They weren't talking to, despite a letter asking for them to discuss their testimony. And we're just sort of left to question, are these meaningless witnesses? Did they have no helpful information for the defense? Or on the other hand, and we'll discuss this a bit more later, are these five or more lost opportunities where really, if Gutierrez or someone on her team talked to these witnesses, they could have gathered various pieces of information that could have completely changed the defense narrative and theory of the case? We'll never know, though. It's, again, a lack of trial prep by the defense that seems to have really forestalled any meaningful refutation of the state's charges against Adnan.
So this raises a couple of thoughts for me. The first is, well, possibilities, I suppose. The first is that, I mean, we went over Tina's incredibly busy schedule, and I wonder if her just not returning the witnesses' calls or whatever was a matter of just her not simply just not having the time to do the prep for these witnesses. I mean, she was doing other cases back to back and traveling as well. And I just wonder if it was something as mundane of a reason as that. She just didn't have the time, because it takes time to prepare witnesses, to meet with them and talk to them. And the other thing I thought was interesting was, Colin, what you said about that you didn't think that Yurik would make this up out of whole cloth. And I agree with you. But I also wonder, and maybe you can explain to me why, that he would think that this is important to report to the court, because it almost seems like, what does he care? What does he care if Gutierrez is messing up her defense and not contacting witnesses that could be valuable to her?
Oh, I'd care. If you have another attorney that's pissing off witnesses and getting them frustrated and upset and confused, that's going to impact your case, because they're also your witnesses. And why he was upset is because I'm sure he was worried they were possibly not even going to show or get confused about when to show due to this lack of communication. That's my guess anyway. I would have cared about that. In addition to this testimony from Drew Davis, Gutierrez also uses him to get across a few other points. For instance, what road he lived on and how it's near a road that Jay says they drove along on the 13th while looking for places to bury the body or just driving around in general. Davis also notes that there's a pull-off spot on the side of the road that Mr. S was driving down on the way back to college. Or he kind of brings this out. That's the point he's trying to make. But it's not very clear, and I'm not sure the jury actually understood what the significance there was, because, as Davis describes, if Mr. S really was driving back to Coppin State and really needed to pull over to pee, well, there was a much more logical place close by on the right-hand side of the road that he presumably would have used, as opposed to his weird U-turn to the left side of the road that he claims he did that led to him finding the body. Then on cross, it's pretty short. Yurik gets Davis to admit that when he went to visit the gravesite, there was a path of least resistance towards the burial area. But of course there would be. By the time Davis ever goes, there have been dozens and dozens of people tromping back and forth in between the road to the burial site, creating a path that wasn't there before. This is shown from the testimony of the next witness, Philip Budemeyer, who was the surveyor who did one of the maps showing where the burial site was in relation to the road. And he testifies that when he first went there on the 9th, there was no path back there.
When I arrived, I wasn't shown where the body was. I walked back toward the area where the body was.
Is it easy walking back there?
No, you have to find a path of the least resistance, kind of the
There's
underbrush.
There's not a direct visible path.
No, ma'am.
Was there overgrowth?
Yes, ma'am.
Were there vines hanging down?
Yes, ma'am.
There was lots of overgrowth. There was no direct way to get back. He had to pick his way back there through branches and overhanging vines. And that there was not, in fact, a obvious path that you would naturally walk down, such as a person like Mr. S, who was going back there to pee. There's no reason he would have ended up at that spot naturally.
That then takes us to the next defense witness. This is the person that has been referred to since serial as Mr. S, the person who found Hayes' body in Lincoln Park. One big issue we've talked about are the two lie detectors that he took, the first one that he failed and the second after they changed the questions that he passed. Gutierrez tries to get the lie detector evidence admitted, but as in basically every jurisdiction, polygraph evidence is inadmissible and Judge Heard doesn't allow it in. There's lots of argument back and forth about whether evidence of his prior conduct involving indecent exposure can come into evidence, and it never really comes in to at least my satisfaction as to what the jury should have considered in the case. Mr. S. primarily, of course, testifies about his discovery of Hayes' body. We discussed this a good deal in both episode 4 and its addendum. The jury does hear that there are several changes in Mr. S.'s story, such as whether he had gone home for lunch on February 9th or not, the day that he discovered the body, whether he had started urinating before he saw Hayes' body or not. Ultimately, Gutierrez, what he's trying to do here is trying to convince the jury that Mr. S. is a viable alternate suspect, but it's pretty clear the jury doesn't take that bait, and her direct examination of Mr. S. tries to paint him as an alternate suspect, but really, it's not effective, and I think all three of us agree, and basically everyone who listened to Serial, that Mr. S. is likely not the person who killed Heyman Lee. What's always been interesting, though, for me, and I think for all three of us, is it seems abundantly clear that Mr. S. did not stumble across this body. It seems that he knew where the body was. He had heard about it from someone. Maybe it was community gossip, but he knew where the body was. And the significance for me is one theory we've advanced, and it's not the only theory, but one theory is that Jay was not involved at all in the death of Heyman Lee or her burial. Well, if we think Mr. S. wasn't involved and yet he knew where the body was, it's not that far of a leap to say that Jay might have heard from community gossip someone else where the car was. And while Jay himself says at trial, I stumbled across the car in my own daily routine, certainly an alternate explanation with Jay not being involved is he heard from someone, community gossip, Baltimore, here's where Hayes' car is, and that would be a very easy explanation, just as with Mr. S., of how a person not involved at all in the crime or the burial knew key information about the location of something important in the case.
Gutierrez's questioning here is completely ineffective. It can be summarized as basically really long, rambling questions of how Mr. S. liked to drive to work, really long, rambling questions about whether or not Mr. S. preferred to work with his own tools or work with cop and state's tools, really long, rambling discussions of how Mr. S. liked to urinate and where he would choose to go for this. Any significance that's in there gets lost amid all the ramble. And Mr. S., he is a good witness in that he's so indirect and clearly a bit confused by Gutierrez's questions, understandably, that he's hard to get anything out of. And he gets answers wrong sometimes, but when Gutierrez tries to show us as him being deceptive, it's pretty clear that he's just being confused.
Okay, so my question, sir, when the specific lady asked you about it, you had previously been given the work order to do the work, right?
Right.
Previous to February the 9th, is that right?
Yeah.
So before February 9th, you knew that you needed a plane to do the work, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, and because you knew about it ahead of time, had you spoken to your supervisor about Coppin State College's maintenance department's lack of a plane?
No.
No, and you hadn't requisitioned a plane in order for you to do your work, did you?
I knew I had one, so I didn't have to ask.
Well, sir, on February 9th, you got up and you drove yourself to work from your house, did you not?
Objection.
Sustained. I'm going to see counsel at the bench, please.
So the two points that she was trying to get in and make ended up being totally lost. And those points, which were that Mr. S. was lying about how he found the body, and that Mr. S. was a possible suspect, really didn't advance the case anywhere. The first, because Gutierrez fails to ever explain significance. Well, if Mr. S. was lying about the body and how he found it, then, as Colin said, perhaps that's because someone told him where it was. And again, the idea that Mr. S. was a suspect doesn't really pass muster. I mean, if he was a suspect, why would he have reported the body after a month? So any ground that she could have gained there, she failed to do so. I will say, however, that Urich's cross of Mr. S. was pretty effective. It was very short, to the point, and did everything he needed to do. Here's the entirety of Urich's cross-examination. Question: Mr. S., are you married? Answer: Yes, I am. Question, do you have a mortgage? Answer, yes, I do. Question, is your job paying you while you're here? Gutierrez, objection. Mr. S, no, they're not. The court, wait a moment, slow down. Objection to the do you have a mortgage question? Gutierrez, yes. The court, sustained, next question. Yurik, is your job paying you while you're testifying here? Mr. S, no. Gutierrez, objection, court, sustained. Yurik, no further questions. Gets in, gets across that, well, first of all, kind of implies Mr. S, despite, you know, any irregularities they picked up during the direct examination, is a family man with a job and a mortgage. Solid citizen. And he also gets across that if Mr. S seemed to the jury somewhat evasive at times and made it clear he didn't want to be there, that isn't because he was hiding something. It's just because he's not getting paid while he's there and he's concerned about that. So to the extent that Mr. S's demeanor could have helped the defense, Yurik does a good job shutting that down.
The next witness to testify for the defense was Coach Tsai. Now remember, Coach Tsai is the head track coach at Woodlawn High School at the time that Adnan was there in 1999. And he testifies that he was a track coach and that he took practice seriously and that students would be disciplined if they were absent or late. He also says that during Ramadan, Adnan was not expected to run and practice with the others, but he was still expected to come to practice. In this exchange, for example, he's asked, so did they have to practice even though they were fasting? Answer, no. He knew, we talked about it, and as long as he came to practice, he was exempt from the actual practice. Question, from actually running the course? Answer, actually running, yeah. He also described Adnan as a serious and disciplined athlete. He said he never took written attendance, but he mentally noted when runners didn't show up. He also recalls having a lengthy conversation with Adnan during the month of Ramadan, during track practice in January of 1999. These are details he specifically remembers, that the conversation happened in January, and it happened as Ramadan was ongoing. At trial, he says he has no way to verify exactly what date the conversation took place or whether Adnan was at practice on January 13th.
What Gutierrez never realized, or if she did, never brought out at trial, is that there was a way to verify these facts. True, Coach Tsai didn't recall specifically whether or not Adnan was there on the 13th, but just because Coach Tsai didn't recall whether or not Adnan was there on a date called January 13th doesn't mean that Coach Tsai didn't have a memory that could be shown to have been January 13th. In Tsai's police interview, he said that his conversation with Adnan was towards the end of Ramadan, on an unusually warm day in January in the mid-50s. Starting with the first day of school on January 4th through the end of Ramadan, there were only two school days that could match his description, because for every other day, the temperature was never above 35 degrees, and therefore would not have matched Coach Tsai's description of a warm day. The first was January 12th, which was the day of a track meet, and January 13th. Both days, temperatures was above 55 degrees. So, since the 12th was a track meet, there was no practice then, and that leaves the 13th as the only possible day that matches his recollection of talking to Adnan on a day when Adnan was there on time and left on time. Given that Jay testified that Adnan was very late for practice that day, arriving at, well, certainly no sooner than 4:30 p.m., but in some versions of his story, arriving as late as 6:30 p.m., this testimony should have been huge for the defense. It should have been another alibi that, unfortunately, Adnan never actually was able to raise at trial, even though he had it. As a result of the way that Yurik and the prosecution framed their case, this whole point with Coach Tsai is lost because, well, Yurik already told the jury, through Jay, that, yeah, Adnan was at track, but that doesn't matter because the murder was worked around track, so don't be surprised if the track coach says he was there, or might have been there. So the jury had no way to piece together how huge his testimony could have been, even assuming that Gutierrez had actually done the work to show that, yes, Coach Tsai was recalling January 13th. So during cross-examination, Yurik asked Coach Tsai, question, you spoke to the police detectives on at least one occasion, did you not? Answer, yes. Question, at that time, they were asking you about specific attendance of the defendant as to January 11th, January 12th, and January 13th. Do you recall being asked that? Answer, yes. Question, and you remember telling them that you have no way of recalling whether or not he was actually there on any specific day? Answer, yes, I said that. Question, thank you. No further questions. On redirect, Gutierrez doesn't do much to help the defense case, but she does bring out an interesting point about the police interrogation of both Anon and their questioning of Coach Tsai. She asked Coach Tsai, "The police came to Woodlawn?" Answer, "Yes." "And you were aware that Anon had been arrested?" Answer, "Yes." "Were you at that time aware of the disappearance of Heyman Lee on or about January 13th? Answer, "No." "Is what you told the police that you couldn't recall whether or not Anon was there?" Answer, "I told them I had no written records of whether he was or whether he was not there." Question, "And that's what they were asking, weren't they?" Answer, "Yes." Question, "Whether or not you had any documentation that would prove that he was there on those specific days?" Answer, "Yeah. They wanted to know if I had any documentation." Question, "Okay. And didn't they tell you that they got the information that he was at track practice from him?" Answer, "From who?" Question, "From Anon?" Answer, "Yes, yes." Question, "And what they were looking for was not whether you remembered whether or not he was there, but whether you had documented his presence?" Answer, "Yeah." So the cops hear from Anon during his interrogation, "I was at track," and presumably he also tells them, like he told his attorney later, "I talked to my track coach that day." So the cops are like, "Well, shoot, our suspect may have an alibi. Let's make sure we can get around it." So they go talk to Coach Tsai, and their concern is verifying that he did not keep written records of attendance, which means even if he maybe can remember a day that might have been the 13th, where Anon was there, there's no written documentation to prove it, which means it's not going to be a huge problem to get around at trial. And they were right, it wasn't a hard problem to get around, because even though the coach did remember the 13th and Anon remembered the 13th, and both recall Anon being there at practice, the jury likely never realized this was even supposed to be an alibi defense.
There's also the issue of what time track practice started. Now, Coach Tsai testified that practice was every day after school, after their study hall, from approximately 4 o'clock to 5:30 or 6 p.m., which is a little bit odd because we have records from the defense files indicating that Tsai told the defense private investigator that practice started at 3:30 p.m., and that was during the investigation, so that was, you know, many, many months before this trial. And indeed, in his police interview, Coach Tsai also indicated that he arrived at track practice at 3:30 p.m. Inez Butler Hendricks had also testified that track practice started at 3:30, with students going to practice after study hall, which ended at 3:15. And Becky, a student athlete that we're going to discuss more in a little bit, also said the exact same thing. So why did Coach Tsai, by the time trial rolled around, testify that practice started approximately at 4? Why did the timetable change by half an hour? We may never know. What we may also never know is whether any of Adnan's teammates recalled seeing him on January 13th. Here's what appears to have happened with Adnan's track teammates. Tina told a law student to look into the track alibi. That student looked at a page in the yearbook that listed 8 track members who medaled in a certain event, but didn't look at all of the 40-plus members of the track team. On October 16th, that clerk then created a memo with the names of those 8 track team members. That memo, however, failed to identify Adnan's track buddy, Will, as a senior, despite the fact that he was listed as such in the yearbook. So when a subpoena for Will was sent to Woodlawn High School, despite the fact he had already graduated, obviously he never got it. And that's what Will told Sarah in Serial. And he's not alone. We've talked to a number of Adnan's track teammates, and none of them were ever contacted by the defense. But Will seems the most egregious because, like Adnan, he was a sprinter and he would have been among the small group of teammates practicing with Adnan on January 13th. He also made an appearance in Jay's ride-along notes, but he did not make an appearance at trial. Will's subpoena wasn't the only one that was sent to the wrong address. You might recall that Krista, the good friend of both Hay and Adnan, also told us that she heard from Aisha on the night of January 13th that Hay turned Adnan down for a ride at the end of the school day because something had come up. Gutierrez, however, never learned about this fact, but not because of lack of effort. A subpoena and accompanying contact letter was sent to her, but it was sent to the wrong city and wrong zip code. As a result, she never spoke to the defense.
Yeah, so that takes us to Becky. She is a good friend to both Hay and Adnan. She, in fact, testifies that Hay was one of her best friends. She says that Adnan, since second grade, was and still is one of her best friends. She testified that she was aware of the relationship between Hay and Adnan, and she always had awareness that he was Muslim. With regard to the homecoming dance incident, she testifies that Hay never told her that Adnan's parents had talked to her, and she's unaware whether, in fact, they actually did. She testifies about the initial breakup between Hay and Adnan in November, and she says it was due to stresses that they both faced in their family relationships. She then testifies that after their final breakup in December, Adnan and Hay continued to hang out, and she said that they both told her independently that they still cared very much about one another. She also says that neither of them, after the final breakup, expressed any hostility toward the other. She both testifies that she is aware of the relationship that Hay started with Don, and she was also aware that Adnan was pursuing relationships with other girls after the final breakup. Becky also says that Hay would frequently give Adnan rides, including daily rides to track practice, both before and after their final breakup. In addition, Becky testifies that she started writing in a notebook after Hay had gone missing, and the notebook, which was introduced into evidence, was about the loving relationship between Adnan and Hay. She also had entries about Adnan's character and how she couldn't imagine him being the type of person to commit a crime such as homicide. At trial, she testifies about Adnan's reaction to Hay's disappearance and ultimately the discovery of her body. So, for instance, here's an exchange. Question, okay, and what did you tell them? Answer, I told them about conversations that I had had with Adnan concerning Hay being missing and the fact that he had been very, very upset about it. Question about what? Answer about Hay being missing. And that on several occasions, our conversations had led to him crying and just being very, very upset. Question, being very upset about Hay being missing? Answer, yes. Probably the most important portion of Becky's testimony is what I would consider very much a lost opportunity at trial. So let's go ahead and go through the examination of Becky and then compare that with what she told the police and what we now know. Question, did you see her at any time after 2:15 when class got out, and this is on January 13th? Answer, I saw her a few seconds after class let out, yes. Question, and had you spoken with her about her plans were for that day? Answer, yes, ma'am, I did. Question, and what were her plans according to her? Answer, she just said that she had to be somewhere after school. She didn't tell me where she was going, but she said she had to leave. Question, and then did you see her leave? Answer, I saw her heading toward the door, but I did not see her actually leave. Question, and would that door have led to where her car was parked? Answer, yes. Question, and were you familiar with her car? Answer, yes. Now, the important part here that Becky is not mentioning her trial testimony, and we're not sure why, is that in her police interview, Becky makes quite clear in this exact same interaction, she's walking in the hallway, she sees Adnan and Hay walking in opposite directions, and it's not just that Hay tells Becky she has somewhere she needs to be, she tells Adnan, I can't give you a ride, something's come up, I have something else I have to do. As we noted a second ago, Krista has told us the same thing, and Krista's recollection is based upon what Aisha told her. What the jury never heard is, for me, the most important piece of information in this case, that we have three different witnesses saying at the end of school, Hay tells Adnan, I can't give you a ride, something came up, I have something else to do, and we have no one who has stepped forward over the last 16 years and said, I was supposed to meet with Hay after school, she changed her plans for me, she never showed up. And I mean, I don't know, Susan and Rabia, what do you think was going on here? Why is Gutierrez not somehow either being aware or not presenting to the jury this key incident of Hay saying, my plans changed and I can't give you a ride after school?
I am not sure that Gutierrez ever even knew the story about Hay saying no to the ride. I presume she knew about it, and you'd think she'd have to know about it because Drew Davis did talk to Becky. He did talk to other witnesses. And this seems like a very important story that should have come out. But it's never actually referenced in any of the defense notes. It's not referenced in Drew Davis's notes. So I don't see how, but it's at least possible that Gutierrez didn't know in the first place that Becky could have testified to this, which may make sense because why else would she not bring it out? She might as well at this point.
Yeah, my only theory is, and this is probably the response that we'll hear, is that Adnan has denied asking for a ride, and therefore to have people testify that she turned him down for a ride at the end of school, that would undercut the defense theory that he never asked for a ride. But that's not a decision that Gutierrez should have made, and she's the one in charge of that. I mean, that ship sailed. Clearly, we have Krista, an objective witness with no reason to lie, saying, I heard about the ride request. We have, as we'll discuss, whether it's accurate or not, Adnan telling Adcock that night that he asked for a ride. So that ship sailed. You acknowledge that, okay, he asked for the ride, but we have three witnesses. They all say she turned him down. It's huge. It is very much reasonable doubt. Yeah, and I don't know. There's no reference in the notes of the defense files with Becky about this statement. We know Krista, her subpoena was lost in the mail, and she never talked to the defense. Aisha, I'm not sure. There's a reference in the defense files about trying to make contact. I'm not sure whether, in fact, the PI ever interviewed her. It's possible, as with many things in this case, Gutierrez made a strategic decision that backfired, but I'm sort of thinking along the lines of she was never aware of this event taking place, and she lost possibly the most significant defense at trial that, again, at the end of school, something came up, she turned him down, and no one to come forward and say, I was what made Hay change her plans, and she never showed up.
So aside from this critical flaw in Anand's defense, Gutierrez otherwise does an okay job with Becky, or a good job even. She does get Becky to testify things like she still considers Anand to be a best friend. She never saw any signs of hostility between them. They seemed caring towards each other, and she had no inclination, based on what she observed about them, that there was any kind of anger or that in any respect Hay was threatened or worried about Anand's behavior. She says that Hay never said Anand was possessive, and she describes Anand's reactions as very similar to all the rest of his peers. Everyone at school and him reacted in similar ways to Hay's disappearance. And she says she never saw any sign that he was lying about his knowledge or lack thereof about where Hay might have gone. But despite all this, she never gets across the most important part, which is Becky saw Hay say no to the ride. Now, Murphy's cross of Becky, it's kind of interesting in that she spends a little bit of time emphasizing the point that Anand was always in Hay's car, which is a mixed point to me, or even one that really favors the defense, because although Murphy obviously means it in the way that, well, Anand was always in her car, so clearly he could have gotten to her car to kill her that day, to me it shows that the idea that Anand would catch a ride somewhere was so common that it wasn't a noteworthy event. It isn't significant towards the murder because on any given day, Anand was likely to be in the car to ask for a ride. So it's not any more or less significant if he did so on the 13th.
And this is the same thing that Krista expressed to us, which is that this wasn't an unusual occurrence. And she wished that the defense had talked to her before trial because she would have liked to amend her testimony. It made it seem like him asking for a ride was sort of nefarious the way it was presented at trial. But if Gutierrez had asked, she would have said the same thing, which is that Adnan got rides all the time from Hay, both before and after the breakup. And it would have been completely normal and innocuous for him to ask for a ride after school from Hay.
Yeah. And here's what Becky said. Question. One habit that you've described is that Hay would often take the defendant from the back of the school around to the front. Answer. Yes. Gutierrez, objection, fact not in evidence. The court, overruled. Question from Prosecutor Murphy. The cars are parked in back of the school? Answer, student parking, yes. Question, student parking is in back. And if students had practices or whatnot, they would often move their cars or perhaps run errands and then come back? Answer, yes. This whole exchange should have been part of the defense's case, not the prosecution's case or their questioning cross-examination. Because what it shows is that Adnan asking for a ride didn't mean they were leaving campus, didn't mean it was anything out of the ordinary. So any significance that could have been obtained from the fact that he asked for a ride, if he did, well, it's certainly not evidence it was part of a murder plot, because there were plenty of days when it was part of just everyday life.
That takes us to Adnan's dad, Syed Rahman. Adnan's dad testifies that Adnan leading prayers to the mosque was the happiest occasion of his life. and he testified that Adnan went to him to the mosque on the last 10 days of Ramadan for the evening prayers that began around 8 p.m. Now, in reference to Adnan leading the prayers, we know that this happened actually on January 14th, and a number of witnesses actually confirmed that, including the president of the mosque, and then the witness who never showed up, Bilal. If you remember from an earlier episode, we talked about this potential mosque alibi, Bilal, who disappeared from the scene before the trial began, but he was able to pinpoint during the grand jury proceedings that he actually saw Adnan at the mosque on the night of the 13th. And the reason he remembered is because they went over notes that Adnan was using to prepare for his talk for the very next day, which is the night that his father says he was very proud of him. Gutierrez then calls Detective Ritz to the stand, and he testifies about the interrogation of Mr. S, Jen's interview, and the various different interviews of Jay. Because the defense can't track down Detective Massey, remember Gutierrez tried many times to serve him but couldn't find him, Gutierrez questions Detective Ritz about the anonymous call memo instead. As we noted in the Crime Stoppers episode, Gutierrez uses this to try and show that the state had tunnel vision and focused on Adnan to the exclusion of other leads. Maybe the most interesting thing in Ritz's description of what Adnan told either Adcock or O'Shea about the ride he was supposed to get from Hay is this.
But in either the information from Detective Adcock or from Detective Shea, the initial information from Adnan Syed was that he had not seen Hayman Lee.
Well, I believe that was the follow-up information that he hadn't seen her. The initial information was provided that he was going to meet up with her after school, and she was going to give him a ride home after track practice.
Now, later Ritz does seem to say that the ride was supposed to take place before track practice, with Ritz again testifying that the ride was a ride home, which prompts a few questions. Was it a ride from track practice? The secretary to the principal said in a police statement that Hay would frequently give rides from practice. Or was it a ride, in fact, home? That's apparently what Adnan told Adcock, and Krista, the first witness to mention the ride, said in a March 1st police statement that the ride was, in fact, a ride home.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, again, layer and layer of confusion. You just, when you think you have one thing solid in the case, even that is sort of unsettled ground. Yeah, I mean, here you have Ritz, and when he testifies about this statement, he says it's a ride from track practice, not a ride before track practice. Is that correct? Is it incorrect? And yeah, I've always wondered about this. An early theory that I had in the case was that the ride was not a ride to Best Buy or to a car repair shop or anything. It was simply a ride home because Coach Tsai himself said that Adnan would often go home to change before track practice. And yeah, Ritz is describing this as a ride home. In Adcock's write-up, it says it's a ride home. And in Krista's police statement, it describes it as a ride home. Was that as simple as Adnan had given Jay his car and wanted to ride home, and you know, maybe someone at his house was going to drive him to track practice, maybe Jay was going to drop off the car. Again, it's just one of those things where we have more questions than answers about what exactly the nature of this ride request was.
Or Hay could even have taken him right back to the school because she would have been going in that direction anyways to get her cousin.
Yeah, that's true. Becky describes Hay leaving right after school at 2:20, being in a hurry, and she didn't have to pick up the cousin until 3:15. So it certainly could be possible. It was a round trip where she would quickly take him home, he'd get something, and then she'd drop him off at school before going to Campfield.
The next witness to testify was my brother, Saad. Saad testifies that he was aware of Adnan's breakup with Hay, and Adnan afterwards was seeing other girls, like a girl named Anjali, and of course there was Nisha. He also recalls hearing about Adnan leading the prayers at the mosque on the 14th, but he wasn't there that night. Saad had the same phone as Adnan, and Gutierrez asks him about the scroll feature on the phone. She tries to use this to convince the jury that Jay could have accidentally called Nisha while trying to use the scroll feature. But at no point during the trial does Tina present the idea that Nisha could have been on a non-speed dial, which is much more convincing in terms of the call being a butt dial. But what we know now is that Adnan did indeed have his speed dial set up on January 13th. Adnan and Hay's friend Krista was the second person called by Adnan after he got his phone on the 12th, and she told Colin that he had her on speed dial when he called her. But the first person Adnan called after getting his cell phone was Nisha.
So I kind of wonder now if it wasn't actually a speed dial issue. Because one thing that the Nokia 6160 had was an autocomplete feature, where if you start typing in a phone number, if it recognizes the numbers, it will autofill that in for you. Looking at the sequence of calls, I almost wonder if Jay was trying to call Phil, who also, like Nisha, had a 301 number. Because you have the call to Nisha, and then shortly thereafter, you've got the call to another 301 number, this time to Phil. But the Phil call, unlike other calls to 301 numbers, has a 1 in front of it, almost as if someone thought they needed to dial a 1 ahead of time to get to Phil. And this would also possibly apply to the Yasser call, the call that happens later that evening, immediately before the call to Jen's pager. Because Jen's pager and Yasser's home phone number are very close. They're only about 2 digits off from each other. So it's just a theory, but I wonder if a lot of those calls that day were due to the fact that Jay didn't realize that the autocomplete was filling in numbers from Anand's phone book. Hence the call to Nisha when he was trying to call Phil, and hence a call to Yasser, perhaps, when he was trying to call Jen's pager.
Could it also have been if he thinks that these calls require a 1, that he pressed 1, pressed it a little too long, and that was her speed dial? I mean, that could have happened too, right?
Well, it seems, I mean, the 1 could have been that if he tried to dial 301, the phone was insisting on autofilling Nisha's number, which it would have done. By adding the 1, he avoids the autofill problem.
The next witness called by the defense is Saad Patel. He was a Woodlawn student. He was Adnan's friend, had known him since birth. He was also a member of the mosque. And he says that Adnan was regularly at the mosque for evening prayers during Ramadan, but unfortunately, as with your brother, Rabia, he was not there for the prayers that Adnan led on January 14th, although he heard about them, and he can't recall whether he was even at the mosque himself on January 13th. He does remember Adnan and Hay breaking up and Adnan becoming involved with Nisha and Anjali after the breakup, but he's not really a witness in terms of an alibi defense who is able to corroborate anything about January 13th. Similarly, his father, Makbul, testifies he was also a member of the mosque. He also testified that Adnan was regularly at the mosque during Ramadan. He testified about the night prayers that occurred during Ramadan as well. He also recalls Adnan leading prayers, but doesn't have a specific recollection of January 13th. And once again, as Rabia mentioned, this is where Bilal was so key. It appears there were several members of the mosque who, understandably, they were going to the mosque every day during Ramadan, and January 13th was basically like any other day. It was really, this is Bilal. He could have come in and said, I have a specific recollection, January 13th. It's the day before Adnan led prayers. We went over what he was going to say the next day. In the absence of that, we had a few witnesses testifying as to the general practice of Adnan being at the mosque, but couldn't really hammer down and say he was definitely there on the 13th, or even that they were definitely there on January 13th.
Then you have Betty Stuckey, who's the guidance counselor, and she essentially is kind of a character witness for Adnan. She testifies that Adnan is bright, enthusiastic, delightful young man, and she says she has frequent contact with him during his senior year because he would assist one of the gentlemen in the guidance office who was working on programming. When he didn't have a lot of responsibilities, he would talk to her. Now, the guidance counselor Stuckey wrote a recommendation letter for Adnan for college, and Gutierrez shows her the letter during the trial for her to recall it and to read it out loud to the jury. We'll put the entire letter up on our website, but I'll just read the last paragraph of it, in which Stuckey has written, Adnan enjoys an excellent rapport with his peers and teachers who represent a diversified cultural background. His warm, friendly manner, linked with his genuine interest in the welfare of others, have been definite assets in establishing his interpersonal relationships. This is a fine young man whose academic record, fine character, and strong commitment to his educational goals make him an excellent candidate for admission to the University of Maryland, College Park. Stuckey then confirms that it's her signature on the recommendation letter, and she dated it on January 13th, 1999. And she says, I date them on the date that I give to the student, 1-13-99. So this should have been a basis for a great alibi defense for Adnan, because you might recall the state claimed that Adnan had left school in Hay's car and killed her by 2:36 at the Best Buy. But you also might recall that Debbie told the police and thereafter testified at Adnan's first trial that she saw him at the guidance counselor office at around 2:45 p.m. So if Debbie simply gave the same testimony, or if even if Gutierrez introduced Debbie's prior statement and testimony into evidence, this would have been a really solid alibi with corroboration that would have refuted the state's dead by 2:36 narrative, or at least force it to change its timeline. But as we've said before, Debbie testifies at Adnan's second trial that she doesn't remember making the statement, and Gutierrez does nothing to impeach her or to refresh her memory. But of course, there's also the possibility that Debbie might have had the wrong day and Adnan might have gotten his recommendation letter earlier in the day, because in an attorney's note, Adnan actually places a letter pickup earlier in the day, but he also might have been confused. According to the note, Adnan picked up the letter at 1:13 p.m., but there's no timestamp on the letter and no obvious reason that Adnan would remember the timing with this level of specificity. It also seems possible that he or Gutierrez confused the date, 1:13:99, with the time, 1:13. In any event, as with so many facts in this case, we're just left with this question as to what time he was at the guidance counselor's office. And as with so many legal questions, we have an answer. It's because Tina dropped the ball.
Yeah, I mean, this has always been a question for me, too, is that, you know, again, she might have just completely not been aware of Asia McLean or confused her with Aisha. One line of thought that I have is that, you know, Gutierrez thought, okay, I'm going to use a prosecution witness, Debbie, as an alibi. She saw Adnan at 2:45 at the guidance counselor's office. She obviously testified to that at trial one. And then Gutierrez decided, okay, I'm going to do the same thing at trial two. And why even bring in this Asia McLean? Now, of course, that doesn't justify what she did. And in fact, once Debbie says, I can't recall seeing him at the guidance counselor's office, Gutierrez, whatever she did before, should have reached out to Asia McLean. But I do wonder whether in the case Gutierrez had awareness of Asia and decided, I'm going to use Debbie instead, which of course seriously backfired when Debbie at the second trial all of a sudden said, I don't remember seeing Adnan or saying I saw Adnan at the guidance counselor's office.
So that was the defense's case. Although it took 3 days in total, it could have been done in probably 1.5 days and would have been better if she'd done it that way. She scored a few points here and there. But overall, had I been a juror in that trial, I'm pretty sure I would have convicted too.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, as far as you can imagine with everything we know about the worst job you can imagine someone doing. There's no medical expert. There's no cross-examination of the forensic pathologist to dispute several key facts. There's no cell tower expert. We're aware of what a handful of alibi witnesses who aren't called at trial. We have Asia McLean. We have his track buddy, Will. We have Bilal. We have other witnesses who in prior statements would have been alibi witnesses, including Coach Tsai and Debbie, who did not provide alibi defenses at trial. And then, yeah, again, my big issue with these three witnesses who said, hey, said something came up and she had something else to do, and yet the jury doesn't hear that testimony from any of those three. It really is a case where everything went wrong. Things went wrong before the first trial, but then beyond that, between the first and the second trial, the state realized the flaws. They were able to correct them at the second trial. Gutierrez got worse, and she got more incoherent. She dropped more balls than she did at the first trial, and her closing argument is just a complete mess that the state succinctly summarizes everything. They tie everything up nicely in a bow. Gutierrez, you can't even understand what she's trying to say from sentence to sentence, let alone a coherent narrative. And yeah, I'm kind of with Susan. Looking at the big picture at the trial, I mean, I might have had issues. I might have submitted questions and tried to figure some things out that don't make sense. But I probably would have been inclined, if I were on this jury in this trial, to return a guilty verdict based upon everything that was presented.
By the way, we don't actually have the audio for the closing arguments. It happens to be one of the days that's missing from our video collection, but we do have the transcript. And as Colin mentioned, it is so disjointed that it almost defies belief. Now, we're going to put the full transcript of the closing statements on our website, and you can take a look yourself. But the portion of Gutierrez's closing that is transcribed is nearly incoherent. And what's odd about this is that almost all of the transcript before that was perfectly fine. When Murphy gave her closing statement, it's, you know, written out, transcribed just fine. The sentences are complete. After Gutierrez wraps up and Urich does a rebuttal, also, it's perfectly fine. So I don't think there was an audio issue.
I think she was pacing or something. But the problem is, if she's getting out of earshot of the videotape, which is positioned towards what the jury is, then it means the jurors can't hear her either.
But I think she also paced during the trial, and I don't think you see this in any other portions of the trial. Nothing like this, at least. It's really unreal almost to look at because, but I don't know.
Whatever she was doing, the transcriber couldn't keep up. It's incoherent.
Couldn't keep up, or I mean, I can't help but wonder if she was having some kind of episode, but that also seems unlikely that it would just happen in that portion. But anyway.
It's a rambling mess. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. So after Gutierrez wrapped up and Urich did a rebuttal, the jury retired to deliberate. And they deliberated for about 3 hours, maybe a little bit less. We were called back to the courtroom 3 hours later and we reconvened. But I think they had actually reached a verdict 45 minutes to an hour earlier when we got the call to return to the courtroom. And it was a big surprise because no one expected them to be done really the same afternoon. There were four charges. Anand was found guilty on all four charges. And that was the end of the case. By the time the state rested to the time that he was convicted, really just a few days had passed. And Adnan was then sentenced on April 5th. And as everyone knows, he was sentenced to life plus 30 years. The 30 years, additionally, because of the extra charges that were kidnapping, burglary, and false imprisonment.
Yeah, and talking about that sentence that Adnan was given, it's interesting because somewhat recently the United States Supreme Court decided a case, Miller versus Alabama, and that ruled that mandatory life without parole sentences for juveniles are unconstitutional for a variety of reasons. And in fact, many courts, including a court here in South Carolina, have ruled that this precedent actually should be read more widely as basically giving broader discretion to judges to invalidate life sentences without parole that are given to youths. But in this case, technically, Adnan is eligible for parole, but I use the word technically because it is technically as opposed to practically. There's basically a dirty little secret in Maryland law, and that is that the state does not grant parole to lifers. And in fact, there's a recent quote given by Maryland Circuit Court Judge Philip Karum in a recent report, and he said basically the refusal to give parole to lifers in Maryland, quote, has obliterated the distinction. And so, in effect, the U.S. Supreme Court is saying it is cruel and unusual punishment to give life without parole to juveniles, and yet you have Maryland, a state where, because of the way that they handle sentences, many juveniles, such as Adnan, have, in effect, life without parole. It's all but the wording that applies. And even with this Supreme Court precedent, they're not going to get any relief. They're going to be in prison for the rest of their lives, unless, as we have in Adnan's case, the possibility of an appeal being successful and leading to a release based upon a constitutional violation. The same day that Adnan was convicted, he filed a direct appeal. That's an appeal based upon errors that were evident from the trial record. For instance, he argued the trial court committed error by admitting Hayes' diary into evidence. Unfortunately, as we noted before, this was a clear losing argument, not because of the merits, but because Gutierrez had stipulated to its admission at trial, meaning the issue was in effect waived on appeal. Adnan also claimed during the direct appeal that there were all sorts of improprieties with Jay's plea deal, including the court precluding Gutierrez from calling Jay's attorney, Ann Benaroya, as a witness at trial. As a result, the jury never heard some of the things that Benaroya told us about the circumstances of Jay's deal, including the fact that Jay basically faced the decision of either testifying against Adnan or having his case kicked to Baltimore County and a largely Caucasian jury deciding whether he should receive the death penalty. And then working off of that, if we're going to talk about Jay's plea deal, I wanted to really discuss in this final episode the impression that a lot of people have about Jay's plea deal versus what actually happened. Now, the official story that I'm sure you've heard starting with Serial is that Jay could have spent up to 2 years in prison based upon his guilty plea to accessory after the fact. But by the time that Jay gets to his sentencing hearing, a funny thing happens. So prosecutor Kevin Urich all but tells Judge McCurdy that he shouldn't give Jay any time in prison because of the helpfulness of his testimony at trial, the fact that he withstood Gutierrez's withering cross-examination, and because, unlike most defendants that Urich has dealt with, Jay showed true remorse for his actions. After Urich makes his presentation, Ben Arroyo stands up, and she makes a motion for probation before judgment, which is also known as PBJ. And she asks for the judge to hold that sub curia until Jay has completed some or all of his 2-year period of probation. Now, what exactly does that mean? What's a PBJ? If Judge McCurdy granted the motion, not only would Jay receive no prison time, but if he simply stayed in the straight and narrow for 2 years or less, his accessory after the fact conviction would have been expunged from his criminal record. In other words, it would have been as if that conviction never happened. Jay wouldn't have had to disclose it to employers. He would have regained all the rights he lost as a result of his felony conviction. He would have had a clean slate. Now, Urich, in response, does not oppose Ben Arroyo's motion. And McCurdy, understandably, grants it. And in fact, it would have been shocking if Judge McCurdy did anything else. When you have defense counsel making a motion, the prosecution doesn't oppose it, and the prosecution is telling you how great this person is, how much they help the prosecution case, the judge almost certainly is going to grant the defense motion. And so now, I think that gives you a fuller and more complete picture of the real deal with Jay. On the one hand, he could have refused to play ball, not testified against Adnan. His case would have been kicked to Baltimore County. A predominantly Caucasian jury would have decided whether to give him the death penalty, or, as happened, he could have testified against Adnan, resulting in no prison term and basically an etch-a-sketch conviction that could have been shaken out 2 or less years after it was entered. In the end, you might wonder, well, why is Jay still known as a felon with an accessory conviction? Ben Arroyo's motion was, of course, granted, but Jay was never given that clean slate. He was never given the tabula rasa because soon after his conviction, he was busted for pot possession, making the PBJ impossible. And so as a result, while Jay should have, if he followed the law, had no criminal record because he had this marijuana violation, he, in fact, was not given the PBJ and he still has the felony conviction. But if he did everything properly, it's as if he never committed the crime. It would have been wiped clean. No prison time ever, no conviction. It would be as if he had no involvement in the crime. Ends our discussion of the trial and what happened in Adnan's case, but this is more of a comma than a period. It seems like almost every day we learn new factual things about what actually happened or didn't happen on January 13th, and we have the very much real-world legal developments, including the opened PCR hearing in February. So we're saying goodbye to the past, but we are not closing the door by any means on this case. And as there continue to be developments, both factual and legal, we'll be checking in with you, both in our blogs and with recordings, updating you on the most recent developments and letting you know what's going on in the case as we continue to try to figure out the truth of what happened on January 13th and to uncover both the factual and legal developments that could very much change Adnan's current position.
As Colin said, this is still an ongoing active case, and believe it or not, despite our exhaustive 33 episodes, there is still more we didn't cover, including evidence and information, the bombshells you've heard about, that we can't even report because it's not the right time legally. Now, so far, our reporting has been focused on covering all that happened in 1999 and 2000, but we're done looking at the past now. This episode is the last in the series on Adnan's case. However, it is time to look forward. So as the case proceeds, we will continue to update our listeners even before next season, our next case, begins. As you all know, Adnan's post-conviction appeal has been reopened and the hearing dates have been set for February 5th and 8th in 2016. It is an extremely tight timeline. Things are moving rapidly. Adnan will be there. His family and loved ones will be there, of course. Many people want to know if it will be televised, and the answer is no. Maryland does not allow any cameras in courtrooms or even taping in the hallways. The hearing itself will be on video, which will have to be requested later from the court. And no, I can't tweet or periscope it either because there's no cell phone usage in courtrooms. But I'll be taking notes, and I'm sure there'll be media present, and a full picture of the hearing will be reported. We will absolutely return in February to do a special episode covering the hearing. Now, I have a bit of a surprise for our listeners. This is our final episode in this season, if you will. However, we decided to do a bonus episode that we are going to release on the first Monday in the new year. There's a reason for this episode, and it's not just so you can hear us yap some more. The reason is this. The bonus episode will be the last chance to fundraise for Adnan's legal fund. Now, here's where I switch out my podcaster hat and put on my advocate for Adnan hat, because this will be the first and last time I do this. And that's asking for money for Adnan's legal fund. Let me start by saying that I know many of you have already donated to the fund, and for that we are very thankful. We could not have come this far without your incredible generosity. As I've mentioned before, the ad revenue from every single episode we've ever done has gone directly to Adnan's legal fund. And we needed this revenue because in 2015 alone, the fund has paid over $80,000 in attorney fees. Let me repeat that. We've paid over $80,000 in attorney fees in the last year, and we haven't even stepped a foot in court yet. That should tell you what kind of legal fees to expect in the coming year. We also pay for investigative work, two different private investigators, and production costs. But after this episode, we're not going to have any more ad revenue for the legal fund. We just have what we have. But we have many tens of thousands of dollars of legal fees that are coming up just for the hearing. So here is what we are asking our listeners to do. If you appreciate the bonus episode, consider donating $1, $5, or $10 to Adnan's legal fund. We did not make it a paid episode, even though we could have done that, but we didn't want to preclude any of our listeners from enjoying it. But if you have the means to donate even a dollar and think it's worth it for the bonus episode, we would be much obliged. You'll find the link to donate to Adnan's fund directly on our website. And again, I thank you for listening, for supporting the podcast, for supporting Adnan, and for any gift you're able to give to the fund. So keep an ear out for the bonus episode. It's going to be a fun one and a great way to start the new year. Before I wrap up, on behalf of the Undisclosed team, I want to wish our listeners a happy, safe, and peaceful holiday season. We look forward to returning to you full-time next year, around early summer, with our new case. Because here's what you can expect down the road on Undisclosed.
Are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah. If there's one thing you could tell people about your case, what would it be?
What would it be? I didn't do it. Beforehand, you know, I was like, you know, no one in my family's ever been to prison. So it's like, those guys in there, they did something. And now it's like, not everything is a bed of roses, and the world is not perfect. I learned that some of my actions caused these people to look at me for this case, and for every action there's a reaction. Even if, you know, I didn't do this, I understand why they looked at me to begin with. Maybe if there's someone out there that really knows, if there's someone out there that was there, is scared to say something, please, you know, say something now. You know, this can happen to anybody. there's nothing positive from this, and it's senseless. So if someone, you know, hears this, please just tell the truth. I don't want anything but the truth.
Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.